May it please the court. Mr. Meyer. My name is Dan Wartell, attorney registration number 34902, and I represent the appellant in this case, Osedon 3 LLC, the plaintiff in the underlying action. Your Honor, this case revolves around the closure of a critical access point to Osedon's restaurant. This common doorway was part of the original construction and was installed at the request of the original owner of this building and both of the tenants. This common doorway existed at the time that Osedon assumed the lease. It existed at the time the appellee purchased the building, and importantly, it existed at the time that the 7-Eleven co-tenant made the decision to lease the adjoining space. Also importantly, this common doorway was incorporated into the site plan that became part of the lease agreement. And prior to the filing of the briefs in this case, the appellant did file a motion to transmit an oversized exhibit, Trial Exhibit 29, which was admitted into evidence at the trial court level. And the court has not ruled yet on that, but Exhibit 29 is an architectural overview, a plan, and as I set forth in the briefs, the architect, the person responsible for designing this building, specifically testified that the common doorway was incorporated into the site plan, which is referenced in the lease agreement.
Mr. Wartell, did the trial court accept that as a finding of fact, that it was incorporated into the lease agreement?
I do not believe the court found either way. What the court did find in its findings of fact was that the door at issue in this case became part of the amended construction plans. That was the only express finding by the court on that issue.
Mr. Wartell, I don't think anyone doubts that the door was there, and I think we understand pretty clearly about when the door went in.
Yes, sir.
For me, though, the question is, what was that door? Was it part of Burger King's, or pardon me, Osedon's exclusive rights? Or was it a common area? Let's begin with that question.
Yes, Your Honor. It was both. First, with respect to the exclusive area of control, the court will recall that there's three components of the demised premises in this case. The first component being the right of exclusive control for Osedon. And to the extent that the closure of this doorway infringed upon or otherwise interfered with the beneficial use and enjoyment of that exclusive area, it was indeed a deprivation or a limiting of the demised premises.
Pardon me for interrupting you there, but we're missing the yellow crosshatch section from the record. We don't have that, right?
Yes, sir, and that's what Exhibit 29 was.
Okay. I guess my concern is, if we're missing that, can we really tell what the exclusive rights were?
I believe we can. I think that
from what?
I think that the record is clear that the doorway was installed at the request of both the original owner and both of the co-tenants, as testified to in an uncontroverted manner by the architect. Similarly, there was the Exhibit 29, which contemplated the inclusion of this doorway. Now, if I understand your question, it is, how do we know that that was part of the original contemplated demised premises? The answer to that question is, it had to have been, because at the time the lease was signed, none of this building had been constructed. And in fact, there's a provision, I believe it's section 5.02 of the lease agreement, that specifically contemplates future construction, future amendment to plans. And so it was always contemplated by the original parties to this lease that there would be amendments, that there would be revisions that would be incorporated into the lease and would become part of the demised premises. Osedon asks this court to review de novo the trial court's interpretation of the party's lease agreement and the trial court's conclusions of law concerning constructive eviction, and reverse the trial court's decision that in the face of the closure of this common doorway, Osedon was not permitted to abandon the lease. And this appeal, as the panel has noted in its questions, really comes down to whether or not this common doorway was or was not part of the demised premises. The lease agreement guaranteed Osadon the right to use and enjoy the demised premises free from any hindrance or molestation whatsoever. And there is no question that if that common doorway was part of the demised premises, then the walling off, the placing of drywall over it, has to have constituted a hindrance or an interference with that right under the lease.
May I ask a question about that? Clearly, Osadon did not have any right to control what happened in the convenience store, right?
I disagree.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me why.
Yes. I think that was one of the fundamental flaws of the trial court's reasoning, because what the trial court said was, even if the common doorway is part of the common area, which includes walkways, or even if it's an appurtenance or an easement, that how can Osadon control what happens on the other side of the wall? But the law is no, the concept of an easement, the concept of limitations on a landowner's right to exclude others or allow others to pass through that land is no novel issue. It's well established in the law that there's easements.
You weren't arguing that there was an easement here, did you?
I am arguing. I think that under the three components of the lease, of the definition of demised premises, I think if we look at common area, it's every piece of the building that's not within the exclusive control, and which would include the common doorway, or it's an easement right or appurtenance. And that was really the focus of the Burrell decision, where the Colorado Supreme Court looked at almost identical language and recognized that although there's something that goes on the other side of the wall, that there are certain appurtenances or easements that do dictate what happens on the other side of that wall, even if it means or if it limits the other side of the wall, that tenant's ability to do what they please with that space.
If I may.
Yes.
Did you preserve this argument that this was part of the easements below? Was there express legal argument about that in addition to simply saying, here are the factors? Did you tell the court, I'm arguing that there's an easement through there?
Yes, I did, and I believe I pointed with specificity with pinpoint sites in my reply brief where that issue was preserved, not only in the plaintiff's trial brief, but also in the express argument of counsel during closing argument. And in addition to that, I think that our reliance on the Burrell decision really is honed in on that precise issue, which is, can a common doorway be a right or a pertinence that even if it's not expressly incorporated or articulated in the lease, be part of the demised premises? And the Colorado Supreme Court, in my view, and I submit, clearly held that it was.
So let me ask you the nature of the right that you are talking about. What is the nature of the right to the doorway? Is it right to use, right to occupy, right to operate? And does that make a difference?
It does, particularly when we look at what the purpose of this building was. This was a co-brand location where its premise is built on the synergies of these two businesses. And that common doorway is a reflection, a manifestation of those synergies. And so when we look at the nature of the right is to allow customers ingress and egress into my client's space coming from the convenience store. Because in an impulse-driven fast food industry, when there's a doorway there, that can mean the difference between a customer filling up their gas tank, walking into the convenience store, and walking through the door to buy a hamburger, or if that wall is closed off, it can be the difference of them walking in to pay for their gas and simply buying a microwave sandwich and popping it in the microwave, and my client never makes that sale.
So let me expand on that a little bit. So essentially what you're saying is, you shut this door off and you have negatively impacted my rights to use the space as a restaurant. But as I understand what happened here is the other co-tenant comes in and says, you know, keeping the door open is negatively impacting my right because the customers are now going right by my cash register. So what do we do in that circumstance?
Yes, and I think that's an answer that the landowner needs to give, because if the owner of the building gave to 7-Eleven more than what it was entitled to give, in light of the lease, the preceding lease with 7-Eleven, then that creates a dilemma that the landowner needs to deal with. If he has promised two of his tenants more than what he can give them, then that's an obligation of the landlord, not of the tenant, particularly the tenant who came first in time and who came when the building, when the doorway was there, and the 7-Eleven tenant who came knowing that the doorway was there and not doing anything to articulate or further refine the 7-Eleven's rights in their lease. So I believe that's the answer to the question. I also think, Your Honors, that the trial court erred in concluding that there must be a full deprivation of the use of the exclusive area in order for it to constitute constructive eviction. In other words, what the trial court said in its findings of fact and conclusions of law is that Osadon was still permitted and was still able to prepare and serve hamburgers to its customers. There's a drive-through, and there's also a doorway on the far end of the building. And therefore, how could its rights to the beneficial use and enjoyment of its demised premises have been infringed upon? But that really ignores the law in Colorado, and particularly the Burrell decision that we've relied so heavily on, which recognized that a common doorway that makes it more difficult for customers to reach your store in and of itself constitutes constructive eviction under Colorado law, even if there are other access points to that same space. In other words, it's not an all or nothing game, and what the court needs to look at is the expectations of the parties. Finally, before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I want to address one last point, and that's what I believe to be the erroneous focus by the trial court on Osadon's unwillingness to cooperate in the moving of the door. That was clearly a fundamental piece of the trial court's decision that influenced this decision heavily. But what the trial court did was impose a duty on Osadon where no duty exists. What it did was essentially impose upon Osadon a legal obligation to sacrifice its rights and to essentially agree to something that at minimum wouldn't help it and more likely would hurt it, as the evidence showed in this case. That's not what the law required. And parties to a contract have a right to the benefit of their bargain that they agreed upon. And in this case, I think it was error for the trial court to even consider Osadon's conduct in not agreeing to move the door elsewhere. I'd like to reserve the remaining 2 minutes or so for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Bill Meyer, number 6562, appearing on behalf of the Appalee, former TCHR LLC. Throughout this case, Osadon has continued to refer to this case as a dispute about walling off of a common doorway. Well, in the first place, as the trial court found, this is not a common doorway. It's a door and a demising wall between two spaces in the building. Second, it's not a case about walling off a door. It's about Osadon's refusal to cooperate to move the door a few feet. And it's not a case about any damage demonstrated by Osadon as a result, even of this closure of the door, because the trial court found, and there's ample evidence to support, that it had no impact. So what this case is really about, and something that Mr. Wortel has not chosen to talk about, is the fact that this is really an excuse by Osadon to try and get out of their lease. Trial court found there's ample evidence in the record to support that Osadon wanted to get out of its lease, pure and simple. And that's the context in which this dispute arises. I'm not going to rehash my brief. I'm sure the court has read it. I would like to comment on a couple of things that counsel stated. First of all, Exhibit 29 is not a site plan. It is not the crosshatched yellow space or the I forget exactly how it's referred to in the yellow cross hatched area on a site plan attached here to is Exhibit B. It's just not. It's not a site plan. It's not yellow cross hatched. It's not what it is. As I recall, and I've got to admit, it's been a year now, my recollection is Exhibit 29 is a floor plan. And a floor plan is something entirely different than a site plan. The architect that was called by Osadon testified to that.
So it's not a copy of the Exhibit B that was attached to the lease?
No one's ever been able to find one.
Okay.
And that's important because Osadon is a plaintiff here. Osadon has a burden of proof. Osadon could have attempted, for example, under Rule of Evidence 1004, I believe it is, Colorado Rule of Evidence, to prove the contents of the document that's been lost by some other means. They never attempted to do that. They have the burden of proof to show what that shows. And beyond that, I would point out, Your Honor, that a site plan logically would not show a demising wall between two homes. A site plan, and there is a site plan in the record, it's Exhibit A, Defense Exhibit A. A site plan shows the whole parcel, the parking lots, the trees, the whole, I mean, that's what a site plan is. And so if there was a site plan, I sincerely doubt that a site plan would have showed a demising wall or a door and a demising wall.
Mr. Meyer, did Exhibit A include any reference to the doorway that we're talking about?
Exhibit A, no. Now, there are floor plans that show the demising wall without a door in it, and subsequent floor plans after the lease was signed that show the demising wall, or excuse me, a door in the demising wall. There are floor plans to that effect, but no site plans that I'm aware of.
So help me a little bit with the standard of review here. Mr. Wartell says we have a pure issue of law because we're just called upon to interpret the lease, the terms of the lease. You're telling us that there's all kinds of factual findings that we need to take a look at here.
Sure.
And this was a bench trial. So what is the standard of review for how we're supposed to resolve this case?
Clearly erroneous on factual findings, de novo on rules, on findings of law. The construction of the lease, to the extent you're asked to construe the language of the lease, would be an issue of law. The court can construe the lease as well as the trial court can. To the extent that, and I don't think this applies here, the trial court did not find it ambiguous, so there's no reason to look at that language. But if you're going to apply the lease to the facts, in other words, the lease says 1.011 says the exclusive right to occupy and operate the portion of the building depicted as the yellow cross-hatched area on the site plan attached here to Exhibit B, to the extent the court were to make, the trial court were to make factual findings about what is depicted on this cross-hatched area, I think then clearly erroneous rule would apply. It didn't make any findings here. What the trial court found was that which I don't think is really in dispute, was it wasn't part of the original construction, that after the fact, after the lease was signed, the Burger King tenant at that time, as part of its tenant finish, decided to put the door in the demising wall, and nobody objected. That's what I believe the facts are. I don't think that's disputed. I think that's what the trial court found.
So given that, assuming that that's the court's finding, then what is this door? And how does it fit in with the language of the lease?
What the trial court found was that it was an alteration or improvement that was added after the fact, and therefore is part of the realty belonging to the lessor under Section 7.02. That was the trial court's finding. I think that's a perfectly legitimate finding, and certainly agree with it. As we've said, and I think counsel's alluded to this, I think it could have been analyzed as common area. The result would be the same, because in the common, where it's common area, Osanon doesn't have the exclusive right to control. The lease explicitly says it has to be used in common with the tenant on the other side. And here is a situation where the tenant on the other side, when they were remodeling their space, said, I need to move this door a few feet down because I'm going to reconfigure my space. And Osanon flatly refused to consider any movement whatsoever.
Pardon me, Mr. Meyer. Would you comment on whether there is an easement through the convenience store argument, whether that was preserved?
No, it was not.
Can you tell me why not? Can you tell me why you say it's not preserved?
Because it was never argued below, Your Honor. The citations in the reply brief allude to portions of documents, including my own briefs, where we cited that section of the lease, which uses the word easement. That section was clearly cited along with many other sections, but there's no argument made below that this is an easement. And my understanding of the preservation rule is you've got to make the argument. You've got to say, Your Honor, I think this is an easement. Let me tell you why it's an easement, not just cite some section of the lease that uses the word easement. That's my recollection of the record. I did check the citations in the reply brief, and that's what I found. And I don't recall any argument. Admittedly, my gray hair suggests I shouldn't rely on my argument, but I did check the record, and I don't recall any argument over the fact that this was, quote, an easement.
Let me ask you about common area.
Sure.
If there's the right to use in common between the tenants, the common area, can a landlord allow a common area to cease to exist? And is that a violation of the lease?
Can a landlord, certainly the landlord has the right to alter common area. For example, if the parking lot is common area, if the landlord wanted to reconfigure the common area, reconfigure the parking lot in some fashion, clearly the landlord has the right to do that. Eliminate, again, I think then you get into a situation where, as in the constructive eviction analysis, is this really a material impairment of the common area? I suppose if the landlord eliminated all the parking spaces out in front and put up a Dairy Queen, I could imagine that would not be appropriate. On the other hand, if the landlord decided to reconfigure or restripe it and make the parking spaces narrower, which with people that drive big SUVs they wouldn't be happy about, I suppose. I think it's a matter of degree. And
well, why is it a matter of degree here? I mean, here one day there was a door and the next day there wasn't. So it's not a matter of, well, it's a smaller door, or, you know, instead of being 8 feet high, now it's 6 feet high. There's no door. So in answer to Judge Lichtenstein's question, can the landlord essentially eliminate a common area?
Can the landlord eliminate
or allow it to be
right
eliminated?
I think where all the parties, the landlord and the tenants, because it's common area, have common rights, and one party refuses to even remotely negotiate, they can allow the other party to, on their side, outside the common area, do as they please. Now, remember, this is a situation where up through December of 2010, the tenant offered and continued to offer for a year. So anytime up during the next year, we'll put in the new door. This was, they did put the drywall up so that they could go ahead and finish on their side, because they had to open the doors. open the 7-Eleven. But they said, which I thought was rather remarkable, they said, we'll give you a year to think about it. And if you, any time during the next year, you want us to put the door in the doors, I'm sorry. I think the trial court said 12 feet away. I thought it was 8, but anyway, a few feet away. We'll put that door in. We'll fix your side. We'll take care of the tenant finish on both sides, so it won't cost you anything. I think that's what common area is. It wasn't a situation where the 7-Eleven tenant wanted to wall it off. The 7-Eleven tenant said, no, I want to move the door in the demising wall. The door is not common area in and of itself. The demising wall might be, but what happens on that wall is something that needs to be reasonably worked out between the parties, if it is in fact common area. If you were to find, contrary to the trial court, that it's common area, then like any other common area, people have to resolve. And if they can't resolve it, it doesn't give one side the right to veto. It gives the parties the right to take reasonable action. And I think what 7-Eleven did in this case was reasonable. So we've got to get our tenant finish in here. We can't have somebody walking through the door for security purposes on the backside of our cash register in a convenience store. We can't do that. But we're willing to move this door down a little bit. You'll still have your passageway. Everything will go forward. As Mr. Wartell said, it's their position. They have the absolute right to say, no, you have to keep it there. We refuse to negotiate. And to the extent that do anything else, we can declare a breach of the lease and leave, which is what they were looking to do. That's all I have, Your Honor. One other comment I was going to make, and that is we haven't talked much about the breach of the covenant, quiet enjoyment, and constructive eviction. I would say, to respond sort of somewhat to a question you asked earlier, there the standard is it a breach of abuse of discretion, because constructive eviction or breach of the covenant and quiet enjoyment is a factual finding. The trial court found factually that there was no constructive eviction here. And I think it's interesting that both of the cases that were relied upon both by Osadon and by us, the Burrell case, which they rely almost exclusively on in their reply brief, and the Kandel case, which the trial court relied upon and which we rely upon, were in fact both affirmances of factual findings by the trial court, in one case that there had been constructive eviction, and in the other case there hadn't. And that's what we would ask Your Honors to do in this case, is to affirm the trial court's findings, affirm their conclusions of law, affirm the judgment. Thank you very much.
Wartell, it looks like you've got 2 minutes and 10 seconds.
Thank you. Allow me to address first the issue of whether this issue of an appurtenance or an easement was preserved. The case, as Mr. Meyer just suggested, that we've relied upon most heavily is the Burrell case, which I think is controlling precedent. And that case deals almost with the exact same language regarding easements, appurtenances, and other rights as the language in this lease. And so to this extent that to preserve an issue, one must bring it to the court's attention, as was stated by, I believe, this court in the Springer-Steinberg case, which I cited in my briefs, we did more than enough to raise that issue and make the court aware of it to the point where we preserved the issue. Number two, with respect to Exhibit 29, Trial Exhibit 29, we proved through the architect's testimony that that was the site plan. And if you look at the language of the lease agreement, it specifically contemplates that there will be additional site plans, additional documents reflecting what the ultimate demised premises is, including Section 5.02 of the lease that specifically contemplates construction plans,
made by the lessee and subject to the approval of the lessor.
Sure, tell us. Move through the architect that was the yellow cross-hatched site plan that was attached as Exhibit B.
No, and I think I did not. And to the extent that that was the impression I gave the court, that is not the impression that I meant to give. No party has the cross-hatched Exhibit B, the yellow cross-hatched Exhibit B. And so as a result, we were required to rely on other evidence in order to prove the terms of this agreement. But to rely on that missing document really is a red herring, because that document could not have contemplated the ultimate site plan, because the ultimate site plan wasn't in existence at the time the lease was signed. And so that may define one of the elements or one of the pieces of the demise premises, but certainly not all of it. And finally, just to address Mr. Judge Loeb's question about whether you can reconfigure to take something away, the bottom line is that the appellee wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to give the 7-Eleven tenant what it wanted, which was the closure of the common doorway, but it didn't want to give Osadon the remedy available to it under the contract or at law, which is, if you make that decision, I don't have an obligation to continue on this premises for another 7 years paying full rent. I have the right to go somewhere else to another location where my restaurant can operate without interference. I see my time is up. Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Please drive carefully home today, and the bailiff may announce the recess.